Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, Episode 8.
The Ocho.
Some sad news came out today in the circus world.
I know. I feel depressed a little bit, I think.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it already, Big Apple Circus sent out an email, and also there's a featured New York Times article in the New York Region section about how unless Big Apple Circus is able to raise $2 million between now and the beginning of their next season, they'll have to close their doors.
It's a predicament that we saw an opera company in a few years ago. You know, they needed to raise a lot of money to stay open. And it's too bad that it's now happening to Big Apple Circus.
It'll be a real shame if Big Apple has to close. There aren't many shows in the States that are like Big Apple, nor that have the history that Big Apple Circus has, or are in sort of the New York City region. Big Apple, for those who haven't seen it, is a one-ring European-style circus show that harks back to a more traditional format of circus with a ringmaster, traditional clowning, traditional acts. It's very focused towards kids. And there really isn't anything like it.
No, it's sad. It's something that I grew up going to. And it's an American-born circus, traveling, touring, tented show. And you know, you and I know the hardship of trying to convince people of
the validity of circus.
Of the validity of circus and circus in a tent that tours with high operating costs. And I think you and I fully believe in the necessity of an American circus that tours in a tent because you can see them all over Europe. It's depressing a little bit that it's at the point of maybe having to close.
Yeah. In the New York Times article, their executive director talks about a theme that I've heard echoed in Smirkus board conversations about how do you communicate that your circus is a nonprofit, even if there's a show. And it's a challenge because people come and they see this beautiful big top tent. They see these wonderful international acts. I don't think people necessarily put two and two together that without public help and donations, that this institution wouldn't exist.
I'm not sure I knew it was a non-for-profit before maybe 3-4 years ago. And that's a problem. Like, that is. It's without people knowing that they can give to you because you have a non-profit status, you know, it's hard to ask for money. What's interesting to me is if Big Apple closes, there really isn't much left. I mean, there's Universal, which is an Atlanta-based
circus
touring
company.
Tented show. Cirque Emanuel Vasquez is a tented show that tours in the United States, but it's a Mexican circus.
Then you have mud shows like Kelly Miller, but Cole Brothers closed this year.
Cole Brothers. And then you have Smirkus, but, you know, it's slightly different just by the fact that it's kids, right? And then you have Ringling, which is in arenas. And
Cirque du Soleil,
which is, to me, not comparable at all to Universal or Vasquez because it's just such a massive institution.
Yeah, I definitely think Cirque du Soleil sort of fits into its own category, particularly with their current Broadway venture, Paramore.
It's an interesting time for circus. You know, I think, like, we're talking with Adam Woolley a bit about it, but it's hard to stay really positive about circus in America specifically because the fact that Big Apple has to fight like to stay open is sad. And there's like so many not-for-profit theaters that are fighting as well, but it doesn't feel as monumental when one of them has to close because there are a plethora of nonprofit theaters, whereas this is like there's one.
One of the few
not-for-profit circus companies.
So if you've seen Big Apple Circus, if you care about the state of American circus, please consider donating to them. You can find them on their website, bigapplecircus.com. They have an Indiegogo generosity campaign where they're trying to raise they will raise $2 million over the course of this summer to fund their new show. On a lighter note,
On today's episode, we have Rob Merman.
Robbo.
Rob ran away as a clown in 1969 and performed in Europe with different circuses. He was also trained as a mime with Marcel Marceau. He was the dean of Ringling Clown College. And in 1987, he founded Josh's heart and soul, Circus Mercus.
It was really great talking with Rob and sharing some of the stories that he told us Smirkos as kids on our podcast. You'll hear about his struggles getting a circus off of the ground, what it was like to travel around Europe doing circus, what it was like to learn mime from the best in the world, and sort of his take on what makes a good clown and how to write circus act. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, share the podcast with your friends, go on Twitter, tweet us. You can follow us on Instagram at Hideaway Circus. And if you have any comments or questions, particularly guest suggestions, you can email those to hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Here's Rob.
So I wanted to start off asking you about where you grew up and what your first interaction with circus was.
Okay, well, that's a good question. I never really saw traveling circuses when I was a kid. I grew up in North Haven, Connecticut, and it was an area of farmland, more or less, when I was growing up before it got built up to suburbia. And the closest I came to any kind of circus activity was at the state fair. There was always some circus acts performing outdoors. And that was really my exposure. So I never had the childhood dream to run off and join the circus. I didn't have that until I was older.
What was it that made you want to run away with the circus? What was the experience?
Well, I wanted to see the world, first of all. And I didn't have any money, so I needed to get paid somehow as I was seeing the world. And I had a sense of adventure even when I was a child. And that sense of adventure meant going out and finding what the world was all about and finding my place in the world. And as a child and as a teenager, I was fairly athletic. I had been doing some acrobatics and I taught myself to juggle and balance on wires and things like that. There were no circus schools in those days. So I was just having fun teaching myself. And I played music, I played the trumpet and some other instruments. And I thought, how could I take these skills that I had been developing, go out into the world and use them, get paid for it, and travel? And circus was the thing that came into my mind. So I wanted to find out what the culture and what the lifestyle of circus was all about. So running up to the circus was a bit of research.
And you traveled all around Europe doing it, right?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can recount the story for us where you end up. Was it in Wales? Somewhere in England, right? Was your first interaction with.
Right. So I was 19 years old. I had $50 in my pocket and a homemade pair of clown shoes and a clown nose, and that was about it. And my plan was to find a European circus to travel with and apprentice myself to some great clown and learn the trade. So I flew to England first, and I started hitchhiking around, figuring I had about 3 days until the money ran out. So I had 3 days to find a circus, and sure enough, I found a circus tent sitting in a valley by the third day, and I went up to the owner of the circus, and I started to explain that I was a clown and I wanted to apprentice myself and I'd do any kind of work that's necessary. And all he heard was the word clown. And he looked at me and he pointed over there and said, "Quick, the show's going to start in about an hour. Put your makeup on over there and we'll put you in the ring and see what happens." And that was about it. It was Circus Hoffman, run by the five Hoffman brothers. They were hoodlums. They were real hooligans. And it was what in England they call a rough and ready circus. What we would call here a real mud show. And it was great. It was a real test of whether I wanted to stay in the circus or not. And the very first act, I went running in the ring with my two new partners. One was Little John, who is a Spanish tap dancing dwarf, and Charlie, who is a big, burly German fellow, who also came in and did the trained bear act later on. And I had to go running in following them, and we were going to do the animal walk around. Little John was going to walk around with the llama. Charlie was walking around with the donkey. This was just to show the animals to the kids in between one of the acts. And the five Hoffman guys yelled at me. They said, "Tex, Tex, go get the camel over there." They called me Tex because, you know, I was American and I had an American accent. They loved cowboys over there. So they called me Tex. In fact, they never knew my real name. I was just Tex. And they had me get the camel, and they picked me up bodily, threw me on top of the camel and whacked him. And camel went running into the ring, and I was hanging on for dear life onto the one hump of the camel. Kept on sliding down and crawling back up as the camel was running around. And Charlie saw that I was in trouble. He yelled at me. He said, "Tex, next time you go around, reach up and grab the trapeze bar." So, you know, I'm bouncing around on top of this camel, and I look up, there's this single trapeze bar hanging down. So sure enough, next time we went around, I grabbed the trapeze bar. The camel went running from under my feet, disappeared. Charlie disappeared. Little John disappeared, and I was left hanging by the trapeze bar, kicking my legs and being a clown. And so I just hung there until the music changed, and I looked back and down into the ring, and the curtain was opening and the elephants were starting to run in. So I just dropped into the ring, kicked my heels up, and ran out to the audience. And that was my big entrance into the circus world. Lots of fun.
That's a great entrance into the circus world.
Yeah. Well, what was happening was these circus owners, the Hoffman brothers, were testing me. And that's what would happen, I found out later when I was with the various shows, is that people would come by and they would ask for a job, and the circus owners would always say, "Okay, do this and do that," and all the circus people, we would later on take bets on how long the newcomer was going to last, you know, a day, 2 days, and they'd be tested with all the hard jobs. And I think that's what the Hoffman brothers were doing to me.
How long did you stay with the Hoffman brothers for?
Well, that was the summer of 69. A lot of adventures with them, a lot of adventures, and, well, I should say misadventures, but we won't go too much into that. Right?
So were you keen once that tour was over to stay in Europe and keep pursuing that line of work?
Yeah, I loved the lifestyle of the traveling tent show. It was everything that I was hoping it would be, you know, the mystery and mystique and the sense that we were different than the rest of the people in every town we went to visit. You know, there were the townies and then the circus people. And, you know, I loved working hard, putting the tent up, doing two shows a day. Then late at night, the tent's coming down and everybody's working hard. We put on our work clothes and our work gloves and we're taking the tent down. And then around midnight, everybody would go into their caravans, the French over there and the Germans over there and the British over there. And everybody would have their meals. And then we would come out and stand around the empty field. We would stand where the ring used to be and put the trash in the middle of the ring and burn the trash. So there'd be this bonfire in the middle of the night. By then it was 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And we'd all be drinking cups of tea and, you know, the steam rising in the night from the cups of tea and the stars twinkling. And it was a good day's work. And the camaraderie of that feeling was just great. I loved it. But to answer your question, I realized that the Hoffman Brothers was a real rough and ready show. It had no artistic style whatsoever. And I wanted to find another show to work with and see if I can find a show that had some style. And the next time I ran away to the circus, I hitchhiked on the continent And the same thing was happening. I had about 3 days worth of money in my pocket. And I bumped into some shows, and I watched the shows, and I just didn't like the clowns. There was a show in Belgium, and the clowns were kind of vulgar. So I moved on. I took a train up to Copenhagen on my way to visit a friend in Sweden who would put me up. And I stepped out of the train station, and there was a circus building, a centuries-old circus building right opposite the Tivoli Gardens. So with my last few dollars, I bought a ticket, went in, and saw the best show I had ever seen, and still to this day, one of the best shows. It was very, very classy. The top acts from all around the world were there. It was 2,000 plush velvet seats. The ring was camel hair carpet. There was a 16-piece orchestra playing in the balcony above the ring. Really a classy show, just the opposite from the Hoffman Brothers. So I was watching this show, and, you know, I had my suitcase with me because I was traveling, and my only thought was, someday I'm going to get good enough to come back to Copenhagen and work in this show, and it's going to take me 20 years. That was my goal. I finally had a goal in life. I would work hard. I'd work in some smaller shows, develop talent, develop new acts, and in 20 years I'll come back and be good enough to work in this show. So there I am thinking that thought as I'm watching the ring boys clean up after the show. One of the ring boys came up to me and said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, no, you know, I'm a clown." And he said, "You're a clown? Well, come on, you want to meet the director?" I said, no, I'll be back in 20 years. He said, "No, come on and meet the director." And he knocked on the director's door, threw me in there. And sure enough, it turns out that one of the two clowns was ill. And I started to explain that I studied mime. You know, I had already worked with Marcel Marceau and developed my skills. And then I'd been in the circus already. I didn't tell him it was the Hoffman Brothers. But he said, "Well, you might be able to help us out, and let's see what happens." And he said, "We'll put you in the show tomorrow, work with Peter and my new partner, Peter Harrison, who was a British acrobat, was one of the clowns in the show." And sure enough, the next day, I'm in that show, and 20 years went by, boom, like that.
Overnight.
Just incredible. And I stayed in that show for 3 years. And that, I consider that my real apprenticeship, because all the great European acts were coming through there, and I was working with some of the great clowns. You know, a season in Denmark was about 8 months long, 7 days a week. And some of the clowns that I worked with, Francesco Caroli was my real mentor from the Caroli family, Joe Jackson Jr., Toto Shabri, George Carl, Bobby Ernesto, Popoff, I shared a dressing room with. And these are names that Americans wouldn't know, but these are very well-respected artists and clowns over in Europe. So that was my real apprenticeship in Circus Benavise in the building in Copenhagen.
Can you talk a little bit about what your training was that you sort of alluded to in this past story with Marcel Marceau and how you became involved with mime?
Yeah, you know, I would say that mime really was my first love before circus even. I saw Marceau perform on TV when I was 15. This was back in 1965. And he was performing with Red Skelton. It was a one-hour show. There was no talking for that 1 hour on TV, which was unheard of. And they were doing skits together, and I was watching that, and I thought, that's it. I don't need to speak. I could communicate non-verbally with just the body. I could make people laugh. I could make people cry. I was really inspired by Marceau. And a couple of years later, I was in college, and I had read in the paper that Marcel Marceau was going to be performing at a university that was about 3 hour drive away. And this was in the middle of the winter outside of Chicago. So I got in my car I drove to that theater in the middle of the snowstorm, 3 hours. The show started at 8 o'clock. I got there at 7:45. Sold out. So, you know, what are you going to do when you're making a pilgrimage, you know, when you're having an adventure and you really want to study with somebody, you want to find out what a master is like, you don't give up. So I started walking around the side of the building and walked around the block, not knowing what was going to happen, but I found an open door around the block, went in, and there was this hallway, and then I went through empty offices and alleyways, and there's another door. I opened that door, and that door opened onto a closet that had all these winter coats hanging there. And I thought, I'm really lost now. But the light turned on suddenly, and somebody was standing there. They said, "Are you here to help?" And I said, yes, sir. He said, "Well, quick, the show's about to start, and it's sold out, but we're going to put these folding seats in the back so the staff can sit and watch the show." So it turned out to be Marceau's show. I grabbed a handful of folding chairs, put them up in the back, and sat right down. And I read in the back of the program that Marceau, that very fall, that next fall, was going to be opening his first mime school. So I wrote him a letter, and I got a letter back. It said, "Class would begin at 3 o'clock, October 3rd, 1969. That was it. I showed up in Paris and studied with Marceau for about a year and started a friendship that lasted 40 years. He was my real mentor. And the art of mime really gave me a perspective on how to move through the world. And it certainly came in handy when I started doing clowning, communicating nonverbally with an audience. And mime was still my first love. Circus for me was a lifestyle. Mime was my art form.
How do you feel about miming now? Because you don't really see a lot of mimes in shows in general. But it seems like, you know, I was reading about Marcel Marceau and how he kind of revolutionized this, like, mimo dramas, and you just don't see those anymore.
Yeah, that's right. You don't see mime. And Marceau, in his last years, he was very worried that when he dies, and he died in 2007, that the art of mime would die with him. And basically, it has. It's people don't see it anymore. People don't do it. And so I've started teaching mime again and doing workshops, and whenever I show it to people, especially young people, they love it. It's new again for them. And they recognize the value of learning how to control your body and create images in space that are very clear to the audience. And in fact, whenever I'm working with circus artists now, I like to work with not just clowns, but with anyone who's putting together a circus act, whether it be trapeze or juggling or acrobatics, hand balance, is that they find that the movements and gestures and economy of movement that is the art of mime really helps them develop whatever circus act they're performing. And so I love teaching mime now to circus people.
Can you talk a little bit more about your act composition? We talked about a little bit about with Gypsy, but I'd love to know sort of what your process is, either when working on your own acts or helping circus performers write new acts.
Well, yeah, that's a big question. When I'm helping anybody with an act, and this took me years and years to learn myself for when I was doing my own stuff, is to find your own personal performance style. You know, I see a lot of circus schools now, they're doing great work teaching skills to kids, but not a lot of places are teaching them to be performers and how to use those skills in creation of an act and how to project your own personality and your own character and your own style. For example, there was one workshop I was doing out in Santa Fe with some circus students. These were professional students, not kids. And I said to each one, I said, okay, go up and show me the first 2 minutes or so of your act and let's talk about it. So one guy got up and he walked over to the wall where he had his unicycle and juggling equipment hanging. And so we're watching him walk over to the wall. He picked up his equipment, walked over to the middle of the gym, then made a signal for the music to start, and boom, he got on his unicycle and started. And in 10 seconds, I said, okay, stop, that's enough. And he said, well, I didn't begin yet. I said, no, you did begin. Just watching, it was fascinating watching you walk over to your equipment, pick it up, walk to the middle of the room. It took about 45 seconds, and we could see you, who you were, and how you were handling and associating with your equipment. And it was really you, and it's fascinating. We were all quietly watching it. But as soon as you started your act, you took on a very stylized performer's, you know, stylization that was fake. And so we worked on how to take his natural movements, the way he moved as a person, and incorporated that into his performance. So I call that personal performance style, and that's how I like to work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with you from a perspective of sort of what is taught at schools, which is definitely a focus on technique. And I think, at least for me, one of the best things about Smirkus was the amount of time you had on stage as a kid just to be in front of an audience and be, you know, forced to not just practice in a room by yourself with your coach, but to be, you know, out there in front of people who are watching you and you know, you feel that reaction in a way you wouldn't just in the studio.
Yeah, that's right. And the training that you got at Smirkus was not just training in skill. It was taking the skills you already had and training on how to put them together in an act. And then you had the experience of performing in front of an audience, you know, 70 shows or so. And that was your real training, your real experience. And it was fascinating every summer to see you troopers in the first shows. And then 7 weeks later, you've totally transformed your style of performing because you've added the element of confidence. And to see a performer with confidence on not just their skill, but confidence with who they are as a performer in front of an audience, it just makes the audience relax and appreciate what you're doing and who you are. I love watching the development of Smirkus kids over the course of a summer.
It's also fun going each summer and seeing the same kids and watching them progress and get more mature and older. And sometimes when you see the kids who are graduating high school that year and are going to circus school, you're like, wow, these kids are really good. Like, this is a really great show. I feel like I'm watching professional circus performers.
Yeah, well, I've heard from a lot of professional circus directors that they're so happy when they hire a Smirkus performer because they get the total package. Not only can the Smirkus kids do more than one act, they're very versatile, but they know how to take care of their costumes, they know how to do their own rigging, they know how to help in every aspect of the circus. And that's something, again, that I encourage circus school directors to add to their curriculum is not only how to be a performer, but what the lifestyle of a circus performer is, how to take care of your own equipment, and how to have a life on the road. Because being an artist, circus artist especially, is a complete lifestyle, and you have to be ready for it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit. When I was talking to Ed the other day, he was saying how you, even in the very early days of Smirkus, were trying to instill a particular sense of community and culture in the organization. And I'm wondering if you can sort of talk about what things you tried to pull from your experiences working with circus shows into Smirkus.
Yeah, in the early days of Smirkus, the kids did not have very many actual circus skills. There were no circus schools around at that time. So So we had to be training them in some skills on the spot, but the skill level was pretty low. So I focused on what I was just talking about, being a performer in front of an audience and taking what you do know at whatever level that is and learning how to show it in a very entertaining way. And it worked. It created a style that exists to this day in Smirkus, where we have a focus on who you are as a performer and showing it. And if you're having fun performing, let us see that you're having fun, because then we as the audience have fun watching you. And so there's that aspect to it, the performance, the personal performance style. And then there's the aspects of the communal life and what it means to be a performer. I wanted the kids not to just learn skills, but at the early council meetings we had every night, I would always bring a piece of poetry or a passage from some book that I liked, or a piece of classical music I wanted them to listen to. Basically exposing the company to all other forms of culture besides circus. And if you're going to be a circus performer out there and consider yourself an artist, then you need to understand what other art forms are all about too. So that was part of the early days culture of Smirkus, is that I wanted to focus on the circus lifestyle plus the lifestyle of being an artist and incorporating all other art forms into that. And that really established the foundation for Smirkus culture.
What did your parents say when you were like, I'm going to start a circus?
Well, my father was bemused by the whole idea. I did go to college back and forth between some of my circus experiences.
When did you have time to go to college? I feel like you did so much in your like very short amount of time.
Well, I actually started college in 1967. I didn't run off to the circus until 1969, which was the year I studied mime also, which would have been my junior year in college. But I was spending it in Paris, you know, and in Wales with that circus. And I thought, okay, that's it. That's the beginning of my career. And I wrote back to my college saying, thanks, but no thanks. I'm in Europe. Yeah. And they wrote back saying, if I could prove that the year with Marceau was worth a year of theater credits, then they'd give me a full year of college and I could come back as a senior.
I thought,
so I did that, and I went back as a senior. And during my senior year, I spent creating shows. I wrote shows, I directed shows, I acted in shows. It was basically an independent study where I could explore my creativity in theater and circus. And I got credit for that. So
that's a dream.
It was great. It was great. And then after college, I went back and studied mime some more in Paris. I went and found Marceau's teacher, a man named Etienne Decroux, and he was still teaching in his basement apartment in Paris. So I found him and trained with him. And, you know, I found that in my life, when you have a fascination with something, you know, you get fascinated by whatever, whether it's circus or mime or science or dance, is that if you can make a pilgrimage to find a master in that area of your interest and do everything you can to study with that master, it'll change your life, which is what happened to me when I found Marceau and then Decroux and then a couple of these clowns in Copenhagen. So I encourage young people to go off and make a pilgrimage, find a master in the area that interests you.
So what did your parents say, though? Back to that question.
Oh, well, yeah, my mother. My mother was the one who, when I said, I wanted to go off and spend the summer in a circus and see what that's all about. There was this pause. She looked at me with slight scorn and said, "Circus, schmirkus, go get a real job like in a bank." And, you know, that's the legend, and there's truth there, is that I remembered circus schmirkus, and I just took out the H and made it smirkus, you know, a dozen years later, and created circus smirkus out of it. And even when I did that, she thought it was just more of a hobby, and that one day I would wake up and get a real job and grow up, you know. And it took a while for her to accept even smirkus when I started it. But she found out that, okay, that's becoming a real job. And she saw how I was working with kids, and she always thought I would be a teacher. And she started to recognize that, you know, doing smirkus was like being a teacher. I had to win her over into the circus world. And when I started making the cultural exchanges with all these different countries, Mongolia and Kazakhstan and Russia, on and on and on, the kids and coaches from these different countries would fly into Kennedy Airport. I would pick them up and drive them to Connecticut, where we would stay over at my mother's house, and we would have all these people from Mongolia sleeping on my mother's floor. And she started to love that. She would wake up and cook pancakes for everybody, and that was their first experience in America. And so every year, these cultural exchanges, people from everywhere would be sleeping on my mother's floor, and she started to love it after that. Yeah. And everybody would, they would all talk about my mother. They would call her Mammy Merman.
Oh.
So whenever Mammy Merman came to visit the show, you know, they would all run up and hug her. And these are kids who could barely speak any English, you know, and from China, from all over. We had, you know, a couple of dozen different countries represented in that decade. And they would run up to her and give her hugs and kiss her. And so she finally started to accept the circus after that we were doing something good in the world.
Would you tell the story of how you picked Greensboro as the headquarters or the original location of Smirkus?
Well, when I started to talk to, when I came back from all my European circus experiences, and that was about a decade or so, and I didn't know anybody in the States, really, in the circus world. I never worked a circus over here. And I started to talk to people about the idea of starting a small tent show that would go to all the rural villages that the big shows didn't go to, you know, to recreate that style of the old traveling circus from 100 years ago. First of all, people thought I was crazy, especially after I said I wanted to do it with kids, working as colleagues with professionals. You know, then they thought I was really nuts. And then they said, well, you know, go to New York or go to Chicago, where the money is and where the people are. And so I turned around and went the opposite direction. I needed space. I needed a rural town where I could slowly start something on my own. And I knew somebody in Greensboro who said, "Rob, come on up here and visit and see what you think." And I liked it. And I found that old farmhouse that was run down. It had been abandoned for about 15 years. Nobody wanted it because it was big and starting to fall apart. But I just looked at it, and I saw all these rooms, and I saw the field, and I saw the old horse barn. I said, "That's it. That's it. The kids could sleep in the house, and we'll turn the horse barn into a circus studio, and the fields were big enough to put up a circus tent." And that was it, you know. And it took me 3 years after I moved to Greensboro to finally get it started. after a lot of failure. It
Can
didn't
you talk
just
about
happen
some of the
overnight.
talk about some of the struggle that you had trying to start Smirkus in the first 3 years?
Yeah, well, there's a lesson here for me about that. I thought what I had enough money saved to buy my first little circus tent that we called Old Blue. It was a two-mast push-pole tent, not very big, but good enough to start. And I didn't have any money left, really, to buy anything else. And I thought what I would do is gather up a few of my professional circus friends, have them come up. We would do a traveling show. I was going to call it the Green Mountain Circus, you know, not very original. And we would do this professional show, and I found another act, Daisy May and her Barnyard Animals, that I thought this would be great because we're in rural Vermont, and she had an act that had, you know, pigs and ducks and things like that, like farm animals. And I started to book these acts. I started to book towns all around Vermont. And in late spring of that year, this was in 1986, suddenly the insurance industry in America went ballistic, and prices for insurance went sky high, you know, 1,000 times higher than normal. And suddenly nobody could afford liability anymore. Playgrounds were shutting down, recreation departments were shutting down. And suddenly I couldn't find liability insurance for my little circus. And so all my sponsors were canceling on me. And what happened was that I had to cancel the tour. I paid off all the performers because I had contracts with them. So I respectfully paid them something, even though they didn't perform. So I lost my shirt. I lost everything. And I fell into a depression, and I said, I carried this dream around for 15 years to start my own little circus. And I spent 15 years getting experience in different shows, big shows, little shows. But maybe I've grown older, but the dream didn't. Maybe I need to change the dream. And I thought that was it. My career's over. I had no more money. I was deep in debt. And that September, a friend of mine who was a theater producer up here in Vermont, Jake Craven, said, "What do you really want to do, Rob?" And I said, "Well, I really wanted to have a circus with kids." And he said, "Well, what? Let's do it." And I said, "Well, I tried." He said, "No, you tried to start a show with professionals, and it didn't work. You failed." And so we started to talk about how we could train kids and start my children's circus. And I got excited again. We worked on it that September and all winter. And that very spring, we started Circus Smirkus. And the local kids we were training, and they were coming and paying me with homemade jams and firewood and canned vegetables to get through the winter. And that was my pay. And 1987 was the very first summer of Circus Smirkus, and now it's almost 30 years later, it became successful. So the lesson for me, when I tell young people, I say, look, if you have a dream for something, don't compromise. Go straight for it, go after it. And because what I had done, I had compromised it, starting the Green Mountain Circus, and it failed. So I wasn't going after what I really wanted to do. So failure into a success story, finally.
Well, that's a really, I really like that story. Yeah, I think it's funny when you hear a lot of these circus companies have like rough little beginnings, which you don't often hear about. But so, at what point did you work with Ringling as the director of their clown college?
Well, you know, it was 1968 that Irving Feld started Clown College because all of their clowns were getting too old. You know, the joke was that the clowns knew how to fall down, but could they get up again? And so So he started Cloud College to train young people. And that was just about the same time I was running off to the circus in Europe, you know, to Wales and getting thrown around by the camels and kicked by mules. And I didn't want to go to clown school. I wanted to go to the circus and get experience on the job, which is what I did. And then it was very ironic for me that 20 years or 25 years later, in 1995, Kenneth Feld calls me up and invites me to be co-director of Clown College in 1995. And I said to him, I said, look, he asked me what I thought about the Ringling Clowns. I said, they're not funny. You know, you're not giving them a chance to be clowns. You know, you're having them run around and do a lot of slapstick and dancing with the chorus girls. Let's let them be clowns throughout the whole show in a variety of styles. And so I tried doing that in 1995, but my real intention was there were two Smirkus kids, Molly Pelly and Adam Kuchler, who wanted to get into clown and work with Ringling. So I took the job at Clown College so those two could get in, and I got them in, and they ended up getting contracts with Ringling, and their careers took off. And then at the end of 1995, I resigned. You know, I had Smirkus to do. But it was a good experience running around with Ringling. You know, and I said to the clowns on the show, the Clown Alley, I said, look, guys, I've never performed in Ringling, so I'm going to join you for a few weeks in the show. So I was a Ringling clown for a few weeks to get that experience performing in front of 20,000 people and seeing if I could get the attention of different sections of those 20,000 people in an arena. And I could, it's very possible. And so Clown Alley and I talked about how to do that, and it was a good experience for that. So basically, people have seen me as a kind of a bridge between the American style circus and the European traditional background circus and the tent shows. And I like to think that Circus Smirkus is the meeting point between modern circus and the traditional circus from Europe.
How do you feel about, I mean, we kind of talked about it with miming, but there was an article maybe a few months ago that was out about how clowning is dying and the idea of clowns and shows and are they relevant? And I don't know, I have my own opinion on it, but I'd love to hear yours.
Oh, I think probably the writer of that article was ignorant about the clowning that's out there. I make a distinction between circus clowning and theatrical physical comedy. You know, there's a lot of good physical comedians working on stage, and they're called clowns quite often, which is the case. You might say it's theatrical clowning. Circus clowning, in my view, is very different. It's a different art form. And circus clowning, you're more of yourself, your own personality out there, and you relate in a very close way with an audience that's in a circus ring. And performing in a circus ring is very different than on stage. The first time I ran into the ring in that circus building in Copenhagen, you know, I had a lot of mime training, and I went out there and I said to myself, okay, I've got all this mime technique, this is great. And I went out there, and as soon as I went running in the ring, I realized how stiff I was, that my mime technique, it was ingrained in my body so I could use it, but I didn't need to be so technical. I had to relax, and suddenly I relaxed it. It was communicating and resonating with the audience in a different way than you do when you're on stage. So circus clowning is very different. And whether circus clowning is dying, no, I would say not. Especially in Europe, you know, circus clowns over there are respected as artists. And Circus clowning is very much alive, though. I would just hope that circus clowns can learn more mime.
What do you think makes a good clown?
What makes a good clown?
That's a hard question.
The sense of humor. Clown needs a sense of humor. Clown needs a sense of humor plus a philosophical worldview. And combining those two things into doing gags. And being silly. And, you know, being silly without having to be forcing cleverness. You don't have to be clever. And another thing that's really important for being a good clown is communicating directly with an audience. Eye contact, the way you move, your gestures project what you're doing right out in space and touches the audience. So it's an art form that you learn in the ring. You don't learn it in school. You know, and when I took Smirkus over to the Soviet Union, it was really interesting because clowns there are very, very respected as artists. And clowns have to learn mime, theater, acting, dance, movement, and all of those art forms go into the background of clowning. I have a funny story about arriving in the Soviet Union without a visa and how being a clown helped me out. Want to hear that story?
Yes, please.
I had made contact with the Moscow Circus to make the first ever cultural exchange between American circus kids and kids from the Moscow Circus artists. And I got back a reply saying, yeah, we'd like to do that. So I bought a ticket to fly over to Moscow, and I had the address, and I was supposed to meet somebody over there. And I was hoping, you know, of course, that they would meet me at the airport. So I was waiting over here for my visa to arrive, and it never arrived in the mail. Suddenly it was time to fly off. And I said, well, what the heck? I'm just going to go see what happens. I had my passport. And this was 1990. It was still the Soviet Union, though it was beginning to fall apart. And I flew to Helsinki. And the guy behind the ticket counter said, you got your papers? I said, well, sort of. Passport? Yes, sir. Visa? No. He said, what do you mean, no visa? You can't fly into the Soviet Union without a visa. They'll either send you to Siberia or put you on the next plane right back to Helsinki. I said, well, could you put me on the plane legally here in Helsinki? He said, yeah. I said, well, let's see what happens. So he put me on the plane. I fly to Moscow thinking I'm really in for it now. You know, what am I doing? But again, when you're on the path of adventure, you have to take the first step. And then let fate take over. Then you can't plan anything. You have to do the first step and then see what happens and then wing it. So I get to the airport in Moscow and I go through this kind of a clown act. You know, I step up to the customs, and customs are always nerve-wracking anyway. And passport, yes, sir. Visa, niet. What do you mean, niet? And we went through this whole rigmarole, and he calls over a soldier and he's asking me about the visa. Yet I have no visa. He calls over another soldier. They have these rifles and they escort me up to the director of airport security in Moscow. And I thought, this is it. I'm going to end up in Siberia. And they threw me into the director's office. He's sitting behind a desk staring at me. I have my bags with me. And I had plastered the word circus all over the outside of my bags in different languages. You know, and they're said in Russian, cirque. And so he didn't speak any English, but I tried to explain that I was a clown, you know, clone, they love clowns in Russia. So he basically pantomimed back at me and said, prove it. I picked up from his desk a stapler, a paperweight, and his cigar. And I started to juggle those three things, put them down, and made the cigar disappear up my sleeve. And he started to smile a little bit at that, but he's folding his arms, and I'm pointing to my bag. See, clown. And he's silent. Finally, I say in Russia, skolka, how much? And he writes down on a piece of paper, 50. And I say, 50 rubles? Which is nothing, you know, which is pennies. And he looks at me and says, dollar. I take out $50, hand it to him, and he stamps me a visa right then and there. Off I go into Moscow. And the punchline of this story, you know, we made the cultural connection and all that. 3 weeks later, I'm back on the plane from Moscow to Helsinki, and there's the same guy behind the ticket counter. He recognizes me. He says, what happened? And I said, Siberia is lovely this time of year. That was it. So you never know. Again, you got to take chances to make anything happen in circus. But circus is like a passport in the world. You know, it's a real subculture all around the world. And once you're in it and accepted in that world, circus is your passport, right?
Yeah. So I want to ask you two questions that we've been asking a few of our guests. But the first one is there a book, a movie, and a show that you would recommend young or old circus artists to read, watch, and see?
A book or a movie or a show?
Yeah.
Well, as far as the show goes, I would recommend Circus Smirkus. And I say that only half humorously, because if they would see Smirkus, they would get the idea of, number one, a traditional old-fashioned circus tent and what a show is like in the circus tent. Plus, they would see a show that has all the elements of classic circus. It has a live band. It has good production values. You know, I could go on and on. So I would say Smirkus to see a show. As far as a film, I actually do a show on circus films from Hollywood. I show clips from about 25 different Hollywood circus films, and they all get it right, actually. But one that I would say check it out is Charlie Chaplin's feature film from 1928, maybe, called The Circus. Because not only is it a lot of fun, you also get introduced to Charlie Chaplin if kids have never seen him before. Plus, he gets the circus atmosphere right in trying to be a circus clown, his character, and it's a lot of fun. Plus, he gets chased by a mule all around the circus ring, which is a classic circus act.
Reminiscent of yours.
I ended up doing a mule act in Sweden in 1976. From Carl Kosmeyer was teaching me his act. He'd been doing it for 40 years, took it over from his father, who did it for 50 years. And as I found out, this comedy mule riding act goes back in tradition. Dan Rice was an American clown that performed the act for Abraham Lincoln in the 1860s. Mark Twain writes about it in chapter 22 of Huck Finn. And there I was in Sweden doing this comedy mule act. And then when I saw Chaplin's film, The Circus, and he has this mule chasing in exactly the same way that I was doing in the ring, I just loved it. So that's the film I would recommend.
Awesome. And is there a book you would recommend?
A book? A book on circus?
A book on anything that you think would help a circus artist.
Or just in better, yeah, or in better your knowledge.
Worldview.
Oh, nothing that comes to the top of my head.
Maybe your book?
Yeah, I could definitely read Circus Smirkus. Both of the histories written by Rob Merman.
Yeah, there you go. Circus Marcus, true stories of high adventure and low comedy.
It's on our bookshelf.
Yeah.
That was the name of the first Smirkus book. The 10-year anniversary that has some stories in it. And then, then there's the 25th anniversary book.
Awesome. And what do you think you would have done had Circus passed you by in your life and that, you know, you'd missed that part? Do you have any other callings you would have explored?
Well, that's a good question. I was always very interested in science. I studied a lot of physics in college, but I didn't have the discipline to be a scientist. I think I would have liked to be some other kind of an artist. If I was better at music, I would have loved to be a professional musician. So something in the arts, as well as being a writer. I'm starting to write now again, and I like that because writing is something that's actually concrete. You have a product at the end of it. When you're a performer, you don't have anything at the end of the show. You know, the show's over, the lights go out, take your costume off. It's very dreamlike.
What kind of, what are you writing at the moment?
Writing some stories and kind of a memoir of life in the circus.
Oh, I look forward to reading that.
Yeah, not just Smirkus, but going way back to the early days and some adventures in Europe and comparing European circus to American, what that's all about, you know, animal circuses. And you know, Smirkus itself had animals. That's a whole other question, but we don't need to get into that if you don't want.
No, I'd love to talk to that. They had horses at one point, right?
We had horses with the Zope Act. Alberto Zope brought his horses and trained our kids to do tree-high pyramids on galloping horses, which is just remarkable that they were doing that in 3 weeks. And we had dogs. We had the world's only tightrope walking boa constrictor.
What year was the boa constrictor?
Boa constrictor was either the first year or the second year. 87, 88. Stuart Lippi brought his boa constrictor up. He's a sideshow performer. And we found out that the intermission of the Smirkus show was 15 minutes. And the last act of this first half was the tight wire act. So we found out that if we put the boa constrictor on one platform of the tight wire, he would start slowly wrapping himself around the wire and make his way wrapped around the wire. It took 15 minutes for the snake to get to the other platform. Exactly 15 minutes.
Oh, perfect intermission.
So we did that during the intermission, and it was great. People taking pictures, and so we built him as the world's only tight wire walking boa constrictor. Truth.
That's amazing.
Truth in advertising.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and I look forward to hearing some other interviews you do with other people.
Oh, thanks.
Well, that was our show.
We hope you enjoyed our interview with Rob Merman.
Make sure to try to see a Smirkus show this summer.
Oh, yeah. The show starts, I think, maybe the first week of June and runs all the way to the first week of August.
Yeah, our friend Mark Lonergan is
That's
director.
That's totally the wrong dates. Oh. Starts the first week of July and runs to the end of August.
Our friend Mark Lonergan is directing the show this year, so I think it's going to be really great.
It's going to be
really seems great. Like he just got up there, actually. I think he's posted a photo on Facebook.
Yes. So go check them out, smirkus.org, robmerman.com. Also, if you like the show, like the episode, please go on Facebook, like us, iTunes, rate us, Twitter, tweet us, Instagram, follow us, and send us your emails at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Have a good week.